So we continue our series called Coexist, and from this week till the end of the series, which will take us through June, we're going to get a little bit deeper into some of the different religions. Today, I want to look more in depth at Judaism. Judaism is what our beliefs were founded on, but I want to look specifically at morality and the law, or what Jewish people would call the Torah. There's a lot of similarities with the different religions, and so we're not wanting to disrespect other religions. We simply want to look at where are we similar to other religions, but how are we different? We want to acknowledge that there is a difference. As I said before, we share the same DNA, 95% of our DNA, with monkeys. That 5% matters. That 5% makes a difference. And what I want to talk about is ethics and morals, because every religion essentially is trying to answer the question, what is right, what is wrong, what is good for human thriving as we live on this planet and as we live in harmony with others. And that's, you know, I've often been known, to my shame, to mock the Coexist bumper sticker. I live in Santa Cruz. I see them everywhere. But in all honesty, there is I believe, a very sincere belief behind it and a very sincere desire that as humans, we can thrive together in the midst of our differences. And so let me just share real quickly some of the beliefs, basic beliefs of some of the other religions. For example, Buddhism has what is called the five precepts. Here's the five precepts. And here's the thing, we won't disagree with any of these. No killing, no stealing, no lying, no sexual misconduct or intoxicants. By the way, one of the things where different religions harmonize the most on is sexual ethics. Confucianism. This is essentially what Confucianism teaches. Do what one's relationships require. So whatever is required with the various relationships that we have, do that. But they will concede that you owe, for example, family, you owe parents, you are much more obligated to them than you are to strangers. Now, by the way, that's where Christianity would veer a little bit, because we are called to love the stranger, care for the stranger, as well as our enemy. But what Confucianism will eventually lead to and has led to is what is called situational ethics. So in other words, each person is, it is basically up to them and on their own to determine what is the right thing to do with any particular situation or relationship. Hinduism, its ethics are explained in Hindu philosophy by something that cannot be imposed. And so it must be voluntary. And it is up to each individual to live up to those. And here's a short list of Hindu virtues. Non-violence, self-restraint, no covetousness or stealing, inner purity and truthfulness. And I don't think as a follower of Jesus, we would disagree with any of those things. Islam has, of course, the five pillars of Islam. You can see the five pillars here. Profession of faith, there is no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet. Daily prayers, almsgiving, fasting during Ramadan, and then, of course, if you're able to, a pilgrimage to Mecca. But I want to read something to you that Muhammad said. He summarized the conduct of Muslim ethics and behavior. This is what he said. My sustainer, referring to God, has given me 9 commands. Now, I'm not quite sure, but he only gives us 8 here. So I don't know if that was the author who wrote this or someone didn't know how to count. Either way, my sustainer has given me 9 commands. To remain conscious of God, whether in private or public. I like that. To speak justly, whether angry or pleased. Wouldn't it be nice if we could do that? To show moderation both when the poor and when rich. And so whether we have a lot or we have a little, to show moderation. To reunite friendship with those who have broken off. In other words, reconciliation, bringing back together where relationships are in conflict or need to be reconciled. To give to him who refuses me. So even someone who doesn't want to serve me, doesn't or considers me an enemy, I'm still to serve and give to them. And then he says that my silence should be occupied with thought, and that my looking should be an admonition. Now that's a kind of a term there where typically when we look, we envy. Eve saw the apple and she desired something that she was not supposed to have. And so Muhammad says that our looking should be in admonition, not in wanting necessarily, and that I should command what is right. And I don't think as Christians we would have a real big problem with any of those things. Judaism comes along and has what is called the Ten Commandments. We could summarize it in the Ten Commandments. More in-depthly, we call it the Torah. Now, I read the Torah this past week. How many of you know what the Torah is? What is the Torah? First five books, which literally means what? Close. The law, right? Torah is the law. Torah is the law. And up until this time in world history, there was nothing, absolutely nothing in existence on planet Earth, anything close to, or as complex, or as beautiful as the Torah. In fact, scholars debate on how many actual commands there are. Some say 611, some say 613. I won't get into why there's that debate, but let me help you with this. If you take all of the Old Testament laws, you can put them in three buckets, essentially. And I don't know if you guys spent a lot of time reading the Old Testament. I was just reminded this week that when I was probably 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, I don't know who told me, I don't know if anyone told me, but I had a sense that I need to read the Bible. Even though I went to a church that didn't exactly teach the Bible, I still had a sense that I should read the Bible. So I approached the Bible like any other book. Where do you start when you read a book? Page one. Genesis was crazy. Polygamy and all kinds of weird things and multiple wives, and here I can't get pregnant, sleep with my servant. But then you get to Exodus and it's like, okay, I've seen the movie and I like that part. About halfway through Exodus, and then all of a sudden it gets complicated. And I never made it past Leviticus. And so then I put it away for a while and then I'd come back to it and start again. I was 20 years old when I became a follower of Jesus. And that was the first time I ever read the New Testament. I didn't understand that the Bible was this very complex, and you guys heard all about this last week, I won't get into it. But let me tell you the big buckets. When you read the Old Testament, you have to understand there are some laws that are related to the ceremonies, the sacrificial system, the temple worship, and we'll call those ceremonial laws. And then a lot of the laws, as you read through Leviticus and such, they're called civil laws. So they're basically on, this is how to behave so that you can function as a nation. How to get along, how do you deal with justice, how do you deal with when someone breaks the law, and it's all summarized in civil law. And then you have what are called moral laws. All right, so moral laws are, and I would say those laws continued on into the New Testament, whereas today, even Orthodox Jews, they can't follow any of the ceremonial laws because there's no temple. There's not been a temple since 70 AD. So that whole sacrificial system is gone. And then many of the civil laws, we look at it from our modern perspective and we think how archaic, it ruffles us. It doesn't sit well with our modern senses and our modern perspective of the world and of what is right and what is good. But here's the thing that we need to understand. We are looking at history. We are looking at a point of history some 3,500, 4,000 years ago. And so I want to talk about the law. I want to talk about the Torah with you this morning. I want to talk about morality and ethics, but I want you to see it from the perspective. We're over here in history looking back on the Torah and the context in which God gave it. But if we could put ourselves over here, say in the time of Abraham, we would have a very different perspective of the Torah and some of the laws, which from our modern senses are wacky at best and evil at worst. And so let me talk to you about approaching the Torah, especially the Old Testament scriptures. I don't know how many of you spend time reading the Old Testament scriptures, but they are so rich and so beautiful when you can understand the context and the historical perspective in which these laws were given. And so first of all, the Bible was not written to us, but was written for us, okay? So they didn't have us in 21st century in mind when God spoke to Moses. He had those people at that time in mind. And so understanding the ancient cultural context is really important. Imagine what Christians may say about us 100 years from now. 500 years from now. Who knows how long the Lord will tarry? They will likely look back on our generation and think, how did they not know? How could they have, you know, used up all the fossil fuels? I don't know what they're going to say about us, but they're going to have something that they look at as odd and weird that we think is absolutely normal. Here's one of the things that modern people need to wrestle with, though. Many people today love the values and the ethics that Christianity brought us, that Judeo-Christian values brought us. Our country, by and large, was built on the values and the ethics and the morals of Judeo-Christianity. Fairness, equality, treating people with justice, yet having mercy and compassion for the needy, for those who are on the margins of society. But here's the problem. Many people want those values, they champion those values, but they don't want the religion or the God behind those values. And it's yet unknown, as our culture moves away from a God-centered culture to where some people are actually championing the death of religion. Religion is the problem. It's yet unknown how this is going to work out. My suspicion is it's not going to work out, that it always crumbles, and it ends up like every other culture in world history: might makes right. Whoever has the power, whoever's the strongest, will eventually leverage that power for their own gain and for their own benefits. Secondly, the Torah, from a historical perspective, was a moral and ethical and cultural revolution. Nothing short of a revolution, a radical revolution for that time period. Let me give you a couple of examples. But let me lay a foundation for this first. Jesus was asked in Matthew 19 about marriage. Some of you might remember this occasion. They came to him and asked him some questions about marriage. And his response was this: Moses permitted you, when he refers to Moses, he's talking about the Old Testament law, he's talking about the Torah. Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. Why? Because your hearts were hard. That is an important theme, an important thread throughout the whole Old Testament. Your hearts are hard. But then Jesus says, but it was not this way from the beginning. So in other words, marriage had a design, God had a plan for human marriage, man and a woman, for life. But because of the hardness of their hearts, he permitted them to divorce. And so keep that in mind. Keep that in mind as you read the Old Testament. There are many things that as you read the Old Testament, you think, God, how could you allow that to happen? How could you could think that that's good at all? Understand that God is working with a particular group of people at a particular group of time. He wants to move them from where they are to the ideal. It's much like raising a kid. If you have a 5-year-old, your ideal is that they will grow up when they're 18, 19, 20, they will be self-sufficient, they will have a job or be in school, and they will be able to survive on their own. And every parent said, amen, right? Okay, so you have an ideal, you want them to grow up, but if you're like me, there's times when you're raising your kids, they're never gonna make it. But you have exceptions. You put up with some things when they're 5 that you would never put up with when they're 25. So that's the best example I can give. Let me give you an example from Scripture. Deuteronomy chapter 21. This is one of those verses where when you read this, you think, wacky. Deuteronomy chapter 21. When you go out to war against your enemies, and the Lord your God delivers them into your hand, and you take them captive, and you see among the captives a beautiful woman and desire her and would take her. Let me pause right there for a sec. If you are reading this in the Hebrew, flashing lights are going off right now. When you see a beautiful woman and you desire her and you take her, does that sound familiar to anybody? What did Eve do in the garden? She saw, she desired, and she took. It's very important here. So in the English, we miss it, but if you're reading this in the Hebrew, you're like, okay, Moses isn't condoning this behavior. And I'll read what the behavior was here in a minute. Moses is essentially saying, your hearts are hard, and this isn't the ideal, but you're going to do it anyway. Listen to what he says as he goes on. You desire her, you would take her for your wife. Then you shall bring her home to your house, and she shall shave her head, and trim her nails. Okay? There's some cultural things behind that. It's a way to start over. It's a way to cleanse someone physically. She shall put off the clothes of her captivity, remain in your house, listen to this, and mourn her father and her mother a full month. And after that, you may go into her, that's the biblical way of saving, having sex, and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. He goes on in verse 14, and it shall be if you have no delight in her. So in other words, you've taken this woman, you've taken her as a captive, you've made her become your wife, and then at some point, you're just like, oh man, I don't like this girl. I don't want her anymore. Listen to what Moses says. And it shall be if you have no delight in her, then you shall set her free, but you certainly shall not sell her for money. You shall not treat her brutally because you have humbled her. Now, our modern senses, and if you have no Christian background or upbringing, you might be reading this and think, that is horrible. That is just completely against any modern sense of what is right and what is just and fairness and treating women with equality. But understand, that sense of fairness, that sense of treating people with equality, that sense of treating women with dignity, that is a Judeo-Christian value. But go back 3,500 years. Go back to when this was written. This was revolutionary. I don't know if you've ever read books. I've read some books on World War II, Vietnam. It seems every war, even in modern times, the brutality of war and what men have done to women in war is horrific. The amount of atrocities that have been done in the context of war would shake us to our core. But here's the thing. See, God understands the reality of human nature. He understands the reality of what happens in war. And so he's trying to establish the nation of Israel as a country who is different, who doesn't do war like other countries, who treats women and captives differently than other countries. And so, as I said, Moses concedes that they're going to do this, but he is not promoting this or condoning this behavior. Rather, as we look at the language, you're doing exactly, and you're going to do exactly what Eve did. And by the way, so are you, and so am I. We're going to see things, we're going to desire them, and we're going to take them. It might be a car, it might be something else. Human nature. That's the beauty of the way the scriptures were written. That's the beauty of the way God brought the law, the Torah, to his people. He understands the human flaws that we have. But yet at the same time, God is wanting to pull us from where we are as a people to his ideal. And so in the context of war, the brutality of war is horrible, but what Moses is saying here, even in the midst of human behavior and war, respect this woman. Let her grieve. Let her get cleaned up and have a sense of dignity. What woman today doesn't feel better when they go get their nails done? I've been on a couple mani-pedis with my wife, and there's something about it. It's not something I want to do on a regular basis, but there is something about it. But notice, treat her with respect. Don't abuse her. Don't rape her. She is nothing less than human. If you go back to those days, they did not see women as equals as men. And yet God has always seen women as equal with men. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. And so don't sell her. She's not property. Don't put her into slavery. You've already disrespected her. You've already humbled her. This was absolutely revolutionary, and that's what I need you to see and understand. And as you read the Old Testament, you're going to come across a lot of things that just seem like wacky to us and out of sorts and nothing like we thought God would behave or want. Third one, the Torah is written in the context, and this is really important, in the context of a covenant relationship with God. Over 800 laws were passed in California in 2019. Over 800 laws in 1 year, in one state. It's roughly about 40,000 new laws in America every year. Because the assumption is more laws, then we'll get better behavior. Yeah. If we have more laws, then we'll get people to align and do the right thing, right? How's that working out for us? But understand that a covenant, and so that's why when we have the law, when God gives the law, and why when you read the Old Testament, you're reading a story. You're reading a narrative. And the pattern as you read the Old Testament is God gives some laws and then Israel breaks them. God gives some laws, then Israel breaks them. God gives some laws and then Israel breaks them. That's the pattern throughout the whole Old Testament. But when you look at the law not as a code or a code of ethics, determining every single behavior and attitude and word, he says, no, it's a covenant. It's a covenant that is like a marriage covenant. It's a relational covenant. It's a covenant that is based on love. And I want you to see how radically new and how radically revolutionary this was for the people of Israel in ancient history. See, a covenant agreement is most commonly known for us in marriage, but it's like a contract. But here's what's important. We see it in business sometimes. We see it in politics sometimes. But the most important thing about a covenant is that it's rooted in relationship. It's rooted in relationship. And so when you come to Moses' summary of the law in Deuteronomy, he essentially is giving the law for a second time. Do is to. Listen to this. This is known as the Shema. Every good Jew has this memorized and actually quotes this as a prayer on a daily basis. I would encourage you, maybe try this for a week or two. Pray the Shema to yourself. Pray it to God. But listen to what the Shema is in Deuteronomy 6. Hear, O Israel. By the way, that word hear is really important. Listen. God wants us to listen. Remember Jesus, he would say sometimes, you have ears, but you do not hear. There is a hearing that goes deep. There is a hearing that produces change. There is a hearing that leads to action. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. I won't get into this today, but there's this mix of one and plurality. The word that is used for God is the plural word for God, and yet he's one. And so right here we see already the roots and the seeds of the Trinity. Verse 5. Love. Notice the word he uses there. Not obey. Obedience is important. But he says love. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. And some of you will recognize that perhaps, that that's exactly what Jesus quoted when he was confronted by the religious leaders. What's the most important law? Well, it's this one. But then Jesus added to it, right? What did he say? Love the Lord your God and love one another. The last 100 years, archaeology has uncovered dozens of covenants. Covenants by the Hittites, covenants by the Assyrians, covenants by the Babylonians. And these documents were essentially agreements between one king of one nation and another king of another nation. And it was always the same. It was an agreement between these two kings and whatever that agreement was. And so these kings from different nations would enter into some kind of a relationship, a formal relationship. A covenant was written, but it was from the perspective of the king. Only the Jewish covenant, only the Jewish covenant is between God, a divine king, and a group of people. There is not one example of any archaeological study where a covenant was between a king and a group of people. It was always king and king. And so this was absolutely revolutionary for that time. Only when the Jewish covenant between God, the divine king, and a group of people came into play, whom he calls, by the way, whom he calls, both in the Old Testament and New Testament, he calls his people a royal priesthood. A royal priesthood. Listen to Exodus chapter 19. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people. For all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. See, in ancient times, kings had special privileges, right? Priests had special privileges. But as you read through the Old Testament and you read through the Torah, you realize that God is always downgrading the role of the king and limiting the role of priests. But notice what this covenant does. It elevates the common person, the ordinary person, to that of a king or a priest. And this is, by the way, the seeds, the foundation of what our country was built on, where we said all men are created equal. And we still had to iron that out a little bit, right? Because women eventually got rights and blacks eventually got rights. And our founding fathers knew that. They knew it would eventually come in time. See, if you take this belief, if you take these essential foundations that all people are created equal, that all people have dignity, that we are a royal priesthood, we are essentially dignitaries in the eyes of God, you get what I said earlier, where might makes right. Now compare that to other cultures, other creation stories, for example. The Babylonian creation story says that one of the gods eventually got his throat cut. The other gods kind of teamed up on him, cut his throat. His blood spilled out into the earth, and from that bloody dust came mankind. And the reason they created mankind from the Babylonian perspective is because they wanted to relax and chill. They needed people to serve them. And that was the role of humanity, to just to be a servant, just to be a slave. By the way, there are modern day countries that have this same idea, different stories, but essentially the only people on earth that are considered divine are the king and his family. Modern day North Vietnam, he is considered a god. He is considered above and has privileges, and everyone else exists to serve them. So you see how the Torah comes in, and God with his people, the Hebrews, completely turns that upside down. Joshua Berman, who's written extensively on this subject, trying to help us understand the context in the world of ancient people groups, he says this: in the ancient Near East, various gods had their consorts and goddess wives. While the common man was a subject, a slave of the king and of the tribute-imposing class, meaning the majority of the lower class exists to serve and provide for the ruling class. For these cultures to conceive of the marriage between a god and a group of humans would have been as unthinkable as the marriage union of a human and a cat. He obviously hasn't been to Santa Cruz. And so Judaism brings us this idea that God is a person, not just a force, not just what the ancient beliefs had about God, but he is a person, and he's a person who is seeking out a relationship of mutuality with human agents. In every other culture surrounding the Jews, humans were seen as servants or slaves of the king. And so every human, according to the Torah, every human who considers himself a follower of God has a royal obligation to the covenant. Now, those of you that are familiar with the story, Israel did not have a king at first, right? They didn't have a king, but what did they do? Does anyone know? What did they say? We want to be like every other nation. And what did God do? No! No, he conceded. He said, okay, I'm your king. You're rejecting me, but I won't take this personal. I'm going to allow you to have a king, and now I'm going to accomplish my purposes this way. They wanted to be like other nations. God gives in. But understand, the intent was that Israel had a king, that God was the king himself. But even after allowing them to have a king, the king had a very limited role compared to other nations. When God said, here's what kind of king you're going to be. Don't multiply horses. Why would you not multiply horses? What was horses seen as in ancient cultures? Military power, right? Military strength. So don't make more nukes. Don't make more tanks. Just trust me. Don't multiply wives, because that's what all the other nations do. I lived for a couple years in the kingdom of Swaziland. The king in Swaziland in modern day history gets a new wife every year on his birthday. And then he says, don't multiply wealth. Don't multiply horses, wives, or wealth. Listen to what he says in Deuteronomy chapter 17. When he takes the throne, and so you're eventually going to have a king, I'm going to concede, you're going to have a king. When he takes the throne of his kingdom, he is to write, listen to this, he is to write for himself on a scroll, because they didn't have books, they didn't have computers, write on a scroll a copy of this law taken from that of the Levitical priests. So the king needs to become a scribe. The king needs to copy his version, not changing it, but his personal law, Torah. It is to be with him, and he is to read it all the days of his life so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees and not consider himself better. You're not better just because you're a king. That's a deeply rooted American value, isn't it? The president is not above the law. We say that. That comes from this right here, that whole belief. He should not consider himself better than others, than his fellow Israelites, and turn from the law to the left or right. And so stay on the straight and narrow, follow the law. Then he and his descendants will reign for a long time over the kingdom of Israel. And so my final point, as we look at the Torah, as you go to the Bible and the Old Testament, it is so rich. It is so full of beautiful things that we can take away even as modern day Christians. The Torah is and is pointing to an ideal. And it's summarized right there in the Shema. What does God want from us more than anything at all? Love. Love me. Love me in the way I love you. And by me giving you the Torah, it's going to accomplish two things for his people. By giving the Jewish people the Torah, it accomplished, here's how you can function and thrive in a relationship with me. But secondly, this is also a way for you to function and thrive with one another. And so that humanity thrives, so that this community and family thrives. But the Bible shows us over and over and over and over that we will rebel as a human people. We will violate God's laws. And in fact, that is the point of the Old Testament. As I said, it is a pattern that we see over and over and over in the Bible. Read the book of Genesis. Just read the book of Genesis, and you will see it is a textbook on how not to do family. If you can't get pregnant, don't give your husband your servant. It doesn't work. It's an absolute mess. The only person that stands out as unique and above all the death and destruction and the disobedience of the book of Genesis is Joseph. If you read the book of Genesis, it seems to read more like a Jerry Springer show. But that is the point. That is the point of the author of Genesis. God's ideal was established in creation in Genesis chapter 1 and 2. In Genesis chapter 3, we see the effect of disobedience and walking away from God's ideal. And so you need to bring two things to mind when you read the Old Testament. Number one, as a people, as whatever religion, whatever faith, all those things I read at the beginning, Buddhism, Confucianism, Islam, they are all beautiful and good and right, and you can find each of those things rooted in Scripture itself. But it will never work, and God knew it would never work, until we have a new heart. And you see that in several places throughout the Old Testament. Here's how Ezekiel put it. And I will give you a new heart, and a new spirit I will put within you, and I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. See, God understood. Here's the ideal. Here's the Torah. They're never going to be able to do it. Why can they never do it? Because they don't have new hearts. Their hearts are of stone. Their hearts are hard. And that's why new laws are never going to work. There's always going to be ways people find to obey the law but do the wrong thing. Think about that. Uber drivers. This just came out in the news this last week. Uber drivers had figured out that when they line up at the airport, that if they get together and they all turn off that they're available, the prices go up. There's less availability, and so there's more demand. And so the prices go up, then they all turn them back on, and they make more money. They're following the law. They're not breaking a law. And that's why the Torah is so beautiful, because it is established and rooted in a covenant relationship that is based on love. You can obey the law and do the wrong thing. You can obey the law and be selfish and arrogant and unethical and destructive to relationships and to society. And so our society is going to continue to make more laws. Fairness, equality, all the things that our politicians want, but essentially ignoring the reality of human nature. We need new hearts, and that's exactly what God gives us when we are born again. When we decide to follow Jesus and we come and invite him to come into our life and change us, he essentially does exactly that. He gives us a new heart. And now we have a desire not just to follow the law, but to love and to do the right thing for the right reason in the context of love. And then secondly, faith. Faith is essential. Faith has been and always been the most important thing to God in terms of him receiving us and accepting us. It has always been based on faith, not on following the law. And that's the struggle that Jesus had with the Pharisees, and that was the struggle Paul had in the early church, because you have to follow the law. You have to follow the law. No, we can't follow the law. The law is God's ideal, but we'll never be able to live up to that. And so we need to follow God by faith. And I want you to see here as I close that this was established early on in his relationship with Abraham. You guys know the story of Abraham, right? God says, leave your family. And what does Abraham do? He brings Lot. And what did Lot do for Abraham on his journey? Absolutely caused problems and a mess for Abraham. And then Abraham lies twice about his wife and says, oh, she's not my wife, out of fear. But all along, God is helping him and protecting him from himself. He's trying to invite him to a relationship of trust and of love. And then when his wife can't get pregnant, here's my servant, and how did that work out? And then pretty soon Sarah's jealous, and then they ship off this poor Egyptian woman, Hagar, with her son to die in the desert. That's horrible. That's so ugly and wrong. And the point of the story is that we see that it is ugly and that it is wrong. But I want you to see, when God finally gets Abraham to trust him and says, I want you to sacrifice your son on the altar. And I won't get into that now, but Abraham knew he would be risen if he ended up killing him. Abraham was doing essentially what all the other religions did around him. But God stopped him and provided a ram as a sacrifice. In Genesis chapter 26, this is what God says as he's talking to Abraham's son, Isaac. Abraham's died. And the Lord appeared to him, that is Isaac, and said, do not go down to Egypt. Your dad did it. Don't you do it too. Dwell in the land which I shall tell you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and to your offspring I will give all of these lands, and I will establish the oath that I swore to Abraham your father. So God made a promise. God made a covenant. Even though Abraham would never live up to his part of the bargain, God said, I'm going to keep my covenant, and I'm going to live up to Abraham's end of the bargain. I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and I will give to you, to your offspring, all of these lands. And in your offspring, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. I didn't have time to get into this morning, but part of the whole purpose of God choosing a people was that they would be a blessing to every other nation on earth. How did they do? They didn't. By the way, church, how are we doing? That is also our call, to be a blessing to this world that we live in. He goes on. And if your offspring and all the nations of the earth will be blessed, because why am I going to bless you? Why am I going to keep my covenant? Because Abraham obeyed my voice. Hear, O Israel. Hear me. Abraham obeyed the voice of God. He kept, and this is beautiful, he kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. And guess what word Moses uses for law? Torah. Now, you Bible students will know this. The Torah hasn't even been given yet. The Torah has not been given by Moses. That comes in a few more pages in the Bible. And yet God is saying, because of his act of faith and his act of obedience to trust God, God credited to Abraham his own righteousness. And that's why Paul argues in the book of Romans, in the book of Galatians, no, we are not justified by following the law. We are not justified by being good enough. We are justified by faith and by trusting God. Now, obedience comes from that. That's where you get the book of James. But one act of faith, God credited to him as if he kept the whole law. Jesus was better than Abraham. Jesus actually kept the whole Torah. And because Jesus kept the entire law perfectly, when we by faith invite Christ into our lives, he infuses us with all of his righteousness, even as he took all of our sin and died on the cross. And that's the beauty of the gospel. That's the beauty of the Christian faith. Our Christian faith is rooted in Judaism. How do you say that word? Thank you. And so by faith, you and I today live in and are seen by God as if we kept the entire law. Live that way. Live that way. Be motivated by love to obey God out of, not out of duty or obligation, but because you are that loved by God. Let's pray. Father, thank you for this beautiful, beautiful story and the way in which you brought your Torah, your law, to humanity. And you did not choose the Jewish people, the Israelites, because they were better than any other group of people. In fact, they weren't. And in the same way, God, you chose us, not because we're better than any other people. There are better Buddhists, there are better Muslims, there are better atheists than some of us in this room. And yet you did not choose us because we're good in and of ourselves. You chose us simply because you loved us and you invited us by faith to come as we are, not as we ought to be. And so God, as we celebrate the Lord's Supper, as we come to the table this morning, as we receive these elements, the cup that represents your blood, the wafer that represents your body, help us to see, help us to hear, not just hear, but to really hear what it is you're inviting us to. In Jesus' name, amen.